Hello, everybody. Welcome to this online event slash seminar hosted by the International Inequalities Institute. I'm Neil Cummins. I'm in economic history here at LSE, and I'm delighted to introduce my compatriot and friend Dylan Connor, who's an assistant professor of the School of Geographic Sciences and Urban Planning at Arizona State University. He did his PhD in geography at the University of California, Los Angeles in 2017. And worked in University of Colorado Boulder before. Dylan uses big historical data to study core issues relating to immigration, demography, intergenerational inequality, and urban and regional development, and economic history as well, and works on a lot of things that I'm following. And you might have noticed he's had quite a lot of success in getting a lot of research out recently in some very high profile journals, including Proceedings of the National Academy of Science. Just some housekeeping before we begin. This is not a webinar, it's a Zoom meeting. So we'd like to see faces, that's good, but try and keep muted. That would be very much appreciated. Be aware that this is going to be recorded for video and podcast usage. And we're going to have time for Q&A towards the end of the event. I'd appreciate it if you type your questions in the chat function. I'm going to monitor that, and I'm going to assess whether the question would be better served by interrupting Dylan if it's a kind of point of clarification on a slide. So if you just type your question out simply, and I'll try and kind of keep track of that, and Dylan, you know, is willing to kind of take questions as we go, but perhaps the deeper substantive questions can go to the question section of the talk. The clarification questions are fine. So I'll call on you if for questioning. And so before we begin, there's also just some notices. There's some more events this week on Thursday at midday noon. There's going to be a public event entitled Wealth Inequality and Social Inequality Across the Globe, which is hosted by the Institute and forms part of LSE's Shaping the Post-COVID World initiative. Further, in a few weeks, on Tuesday, the 2nd of March, there will also be the event Intersectionality, Intimacy and Inequality, Repartnering Class and Race / Ethnicity Among Divorced Women in the Second Phase of Life at 1 p.m. Greenwich Mean Time. Details about events can be found in the chat function. Thanks, and as well as more information on further upcoming events and also other stuff related to the work of the International Inequalities Institute, including work and papers and news on research. Okay, so let's get cracking. And yeah, Dylan, welcome to LSE, and we're all very excited to hear about your research.
Thanks for that introduction, Neil. Thanks for joining us, everyone. It's sad not to be able to visit London. You know, the downshot is that it's 5:30 in the morning in Arizona, but the upshot is I can see a couple of my brothers are in the talk, so my family can join the seminar. So thanks for that. So, and thanks for the organizers for inviting me to do this. So what I'm going to talk about today are a couple of projects on the geography of social mobility in the United States. And I'm really hoping to really kind of move over or move through two separate projects. So the first of these is going to be a project that I've been working on for a good couple of years now, which is really on trying to understand the long-term social mobility or the geography of social mobility in the United States. And then if I get a little bit of time at the end, what I'm hoping to do is to move on to some much newer work, which is very fresh. So the first project is in collaboration with Michael Storper. The early findings from this project have been published in PNAS. The second project is in collaboration with Michael again, but also with Tom Kemeny, who's involved with the seminar. So I'm hoping to basically transition from a little bit of the old and into the very, very new. So Let me just start by talking a little bit about what I mean by social mobility, and in particular, intergenerational social mobility. So what we're really talking about here is not social mobility necessarily in one's lifetime or intragenerational mobility. What we're talking about is the degree to which the family or the parents that you're born into is the determinative force in shaping your life outcomes or your life chances, right? So effectively, we're looking at occupational or income or class mobility from parents to children over time. So you can imagine that in a society where social mobility is very low, the parents that you're born to have a major impact in where you end up as an adult. And in a society where social mobility is very high, the family you're born into is relatively less important. There's two, in terms of the social science of social mobility, I think there's really two big findings coming out of the US literature at the moment. The first is that along several different measures of social mobility, we're seeing big declines over the long term in the US. So in the United States, the American dream, the land of opportunity, a place that has this kind of cultural heritage of opportunity, what we're actually starting to find out is actually the US is a lot less exceptional today than we thought it was in the past. On the right-hand side here, you have a graph which tracks effectively the percent of children that earn more than their parents at the same age. And so what you can see in the US in 1940 is that roughly 9 out of 10 children earned more than their parents when you made a comparison between the two at the same age. But what you see up until the birth cohorts born in the early 1980s, what you see is that percentage has dropped from about 90% down to as low as 50%, right? So it's basically a 50-50 shot for the birth cohorts born in the 80s that they'll outpace their parents in terms of earnings. And we see these long-term declines across many metrics of social mobility in the United States. The second major finding is that when asking the question of whether the United States is the land of opportunity, what we've started to find out is actually that social mobility is much more geographically variable than we previously expected. So on the left-hand side, you see a map here, which I'll return to later on, which shows lighter areas in the US that have very high levels of social mobility, and these bluer areas have much lower levels of social mobility. So really, it's more of a question of where is the land of opportunity rather than whether or not the US is this exceptional society. So stitching these two things together, the decline of mobility and then this geographical variation, what policymakers have started to push toward is to say, actually, well, maybe this geographically variegated picture is one lens or insight into how we can actually improve mobility opportunities. So policymakers, planners, social scientists are now arguing that actually one way to improve social mobility is actually to try and make low social mobility places more like high social mobility places, right? So effectively enact place-based policies that would boost social mobility at the local level, and that would lift the societal rate of upward mobility. And just to make a quick note, the most recent series of events, I think, that have really pushed social mobility back onto the radar, you know, as early as the last year, is the protests around Black Lives Matter and the Black Lives Matter movement. And a lot of the discourse there has been around the lack of long-term social mobility in the African-American community in the US as a potential source for, you know, many of the protests that we've seen over the last year. So there's really kind of wide-ranging consequences potentially for a society that's relatively low social mobility. Okay, so where does this leave us? So one of the issues here then is that although policymakers are advocating for place-based policies and trying to make, as I said a moment ago, low social mobility places more like high social mobility places, there has actually been almost no research in trying to study how places change in their ability to provide opportunities for kids born into poverty. So this is kind of a policy argument that's really off the basis of very little knowledge on how, you know, to what degree we can actually boost social mobility in places. So what we're doing here is we're actually taking as far as I'm aware, the first deep dive into understanding how social mobility changes across places over the long term. And so we're really effectively focusing on two distinct questions, and I'm going to just parse through the findings related to these questions. The first is to ask whether the current geography of opportunity that we observe in the United States, is that geography of opportunity something new, or is it a continuation of long-term trends? And so the idea is that if it's something new, then perhaps we can try to focus in on what exactly it is that's shaping those outcomes and when things changed. But if it's a continuation of long-term trends, perhaps the sources of social mobility are much more deeply rooted and as a result would be harder to change through policy. The second question is then to ask, well, if we do find change or persistence in the landscape of opportunity in the US, what forces are driving those changes? So in effect, we're actually looking at differences between places that have been either, you know, positive or negative in boosting social mobility and trying to understand where those differences come from, how persistent they are, and what forces are underlying any change or persistence that we find. So a moment ago I said that this is a field that really hasn't been explored very much, and there's really a very obvious question for why there hasn't been that much digging into these kind of questions, even though it seems like something that social scientists would want to pursue. And the real issue here is that intergenerational mobility is one of those processes whereby to study it, you need to have a really good sense of where people begin and where they end up. So if you think about most standard census data collection procedures in many countries, effectively the census comes along every 10 years or so. It asks people to, provide a whole range of characteristics. And then the census takers go off and then they come back 10 years ago and they take a new census. So you can think about the census effectively as a snapshot of a population in multiple time periods. But the real missing link there is that the census tends not to follow people through those censuses. So you can't actually ask questions about where people start and where they end up, because we have this kind of cross-sectional nature to the census. So what we've seen over the last 5 years or so, both in historical research and in contemporary research, is an opening up of many longitudinal data sets, where data sets actually start to follow people across multiple time periods from childhood into adulthood. And this is just a snapshot of the kind of base documents that the data that we built come from, the 1920 decennial census and the 1940 decennial census. These have been fully digitized now, and I've been part of a group which have been focused on linking people between those censuses and then following them over time. In effect, creating an origin and a destination to be able to study social mobility. So to undertake this project, we needed to build a pretty extensive database. It took, been working on it for several years. And it's effectively composed of two different pieces. So the first was the most labor-intensive on our end, which is an early 20th century longitudinal database. It's made up of kids who were born in the 1900 to 1915 birth cohorts. And effectively, we pick these kids up and we identify which kids are living with low-income parents in 1920. Okay, so we identify children, sons in particular, who are living with low-income fathers in 1920. And then we follow those kids to adulthood in 1940. And then the idea there is that we're going to see actually which places enable those children to move up the economic hierarchy between 1920 and 1940. And thus, produce that kind of picture of a landscape of opportunity in the past. And then we join these estimates to recent estimates from Raj Chetty's group, which focuses on the 1980 to 82 birth cohorts and follows those kids, picks them up in 1996, and then follows them into the early 2000s. And so the idea then is that we stitch these two estimates together at the place level to see which places provided opportunity in the past, which places provide opportunity today, describe those changes, and then also look at how the characteristics of those places track with changes in mobility over time. Is everything okay with slides and technical stuff? Any issues? We're good?
Very good.
Okay, so let's start to jump into these findings a little bit and see what we're picking up. So this is the primary map that comes out of the early 20th century analysis. And what we have here are light areas. So this is the adult income rank of children born to parents below the median. So it's basically the kind of, you can think about it as the kind of average income level of kids who are born to parents in the bottom half. And what you can see here is that light areas, yellow areas, are places that are providing opportunities for upward mobility in the early 20th century. These kind of darker blue areas, mobility is really, really constrained. So on the lowest end, effectively, this 0.24, this suggests that effectively the kids are making no upward mobility at all on their parents' generation, which would be, you know, which is exceptionally low social mobility. There's not even a regression to the mean going on there. So let me just pick out, I know not everybody's 100% familiar with the major regions of the US. So what you can see in the light areas, we have this mixture of the Northeast as a high mobility region with your kind of New Yorks and your Bostons, the Midwest, and you've got your Detroit and Chicago. And then you have these Western regions of the country, which includes California, cities like Denver and Phoenix. But you also have many rural areas in the US. So you kind of have this kind of partition between the Northeast and the Midwest. The main industrial corridor in the US is a high opportunity region in the past, and also the West as particularly strong springboards of upward mobility.
Dylan, can I ask a clarification question?
Sure.
Just very quickly, when you're talking about sons born in the 25th percentile, is that percentile calculated at the national level or is it at this subunit level? I guess the broader thing is related to where, like, is this truly a relative measure or is it also an absolute, is there an element of absolute mobility in here too?
So this 25th percentile is the national 25th percentile. So really what we're thinking about there are, you'd have the sons in the early 20th century, you'd be basically thinking about the kids of urban laborers, the kids of rural laborers, the kids of farmers, kids of sharecroppers. That's kind of basically the, you know, that, those would be the groups that would be in that. So it's a national definition and definitely the local thing could be something we could pursue in more detail. In terms of low social mobility, really, you can pick out two main regions. The South, which is going to be particularly important in this talk, really jumps out as a really low mobility region. And then there's this upper Midwest kind of plains region, which also seems to kind of, in the early 20th century at least, give off this signal of low social mobility. So this is the map now of the late 20th century. And so what we're interested in are picking up patterns of change and persistence. And there's a couple of things that jump out. So let me just start with the South, which I think is the, you know, the really kind of striking feature of both maps. So in effect, the South is a low mobility region in the early 20th century and also really jumps out as a low mobility region also in the late 20th century. So you kind of have this really kind of strong persistence of low social mobility across, you know, over 100 years. The second, you know, thing to kind of to catch your eye then is also that in the previous map, you can see that this kind of Midwestern region, you know, heavily industrial, is a high mobility region in the past. And that's really seemed to have experienced a bit of a collapse in social mobility rates over the 20th century. So you've got the Rust Belt and the South basically as these two kind of low mobility regions in the most recent period. And then you can see in the Northeast and the Midwest, you see much more mixed outcomes than you saw in the previous picture. So there does seem to be some areas of high mobility. It's generally a much patchier picture, suggesting that outcomes in these places are much more varied. And really the high mobility region, which I think was a surprising feature of the original work in this area, is that the plains and the mountains and actually these more sparsely populated places seem to be the places where kids were growing up, often moving elsewhere and actually doing quite well in their later careers. So you have a much more complicated picture, effectively, of mobility in the late 20th century. So this is just another view on the same set of outcomes. On the x-axis, you have the income rank of those children in the early 20th century, and on the y-axis, you have those kids in the late 20th century. And I just want to quickly scroll through the kind of main clusters that you can pick out here. You can see the Midwest, Northeast, and West, those kind of classically industrial regions. You can see they're very far shifted right on this graph, but they're shifted very far right on the x-axis, but they're shifted more to the middle on the y-axis, which is this kind of same pattern of very high mobility in the past, but kind of sinking much more toward the mean in the late 20th century. The northern plains and mountain regions, those kind of more sparsely populated places in the middle of the country have really kind of ascended to being the highest mobility places. I'm not going to get too much into what's going on there in this talk, but I'm happy to talk a bit more about it in the questions if people are interested. And the really striking feature of this graph is that the south, so the blue areas in this graph are rural areas in these regions, and the kind of more orangey color are the urban areas in these regions. The urban and rural areas of the south are really concentrated in this bottom left corner, which is really pointing to the fact that this is a really mobility constrained region throughout the 20th century. So in effect, you can see patterns of both change and persistence across the century. So to try to get into the kind of issue of actually, well, what forces seem to track with change and stability over time? How do we explain these patterns, and you know, what kind of forces might be at work here? We came up with this graph, which is effectively measuring different characteristics of places and then looking at how those characteristics are associated with mobility outcomes over the long term. So I often tell people that this graph is like one of those like classic, you know, moments that a social scientist has. It's one of those it's one of those places where I began with a particular idea of, you know, how I might try to frame these findings and what I think might be going on. And then when I created the graph, I had that aha moment where I was like, oh, you know, oh my God, this is like why I became a social scientist, the pattern exactly, you know, it immediately comes out, I think, once you see it. So let me just quickly explain the intuition of what's going on here. We effectively have places in the early 20th century. And what I do is I score these places on a range of characteristics, relate from economic characteristics down to socio-demographic characteristics, education, income inequality, and the Black population share, and so on. So these are the characteristics of places in the early 20th century. And then I correlate those characteristics with mobility outcomes in both the early 20th century and in the late 20th century. So effectively it's saying, if you're a place in the early 20th century with these characteristics, how do your social mobility outcomes look over the short and the long term? So the blue dot is going to be the correlation with the early 20th century, and the orange triangle is going to be the correlation with social mobility in that place in the late 20th century. Okay, so what you see when you look at these first three characteristics, which are effectively features of incomes, jobs, and the second set of characteristics in a moment, which will be cities, you see this gap between these outcomes. So what this means is that these dots are shifted to the right, so they have this strong positive correlation. That suggests that median household income, for example, is very positively correlated with social mobility in the early 20th century. But this orange triangle, which is close to this dotted line, which is effectively the zero correlation, social mobility in that place, there's effectively no correlation between social mobility in high income places in the early 20th century over the long term. So let me just restate that. So the rightward shift of the blue circle says that there's a strong early 20th century correlation between incomes and social mobility. If you look at that same place over the long term, that correlation effectively disappears. Okay, so this suggests that the leading economic regions of the early 20th century lost their advantage in social mobility. The manufacturing share is just a notable case here, because manufacturing, of course, was the leading economic sector of the early 20th century. You see a similar pattern, although less pronounced. You see this gap between the orange and the blue, suggesting that indicators of urbanization in the early 20th century have this short-term association with social mobility, but the correlation kind of disappears as you move through time. But watch what happens when we transition now to the second set of characteristics. So income inequality, the high school dropout rate, the foreign-born share, and the Black population share. So in effect, what you start to see here is a much tighter coupling of the two sets of outcomes. So if you track the high school dropout rate, for example, here, there's a strong negative correlation between the high school dropout in the early 20th century of a place and its social mobility in the early 20th century, but also in the late 20th century. So effectively what that's saying is that places that had poor high school dropout rates in the early 20th century continued to have bad social mobility over the 20th century. So there's a really tight coupling here of these outcomes, and an even tighter coupling of these outcomes when you look at the foreign-born share and the Black population share. So if you just focus on the Black population share, for example, look how consistent those outcomes are over time, right? There's effectively a strong negative correlation, like in excess of 0.5 is very high, between the Black population share in the early 20th century and then mobility throughout the 20th century. So effectively what you have is this kind of unusual split where you have change among the economic characteristics, but a very high level of persistence among characteristics related to interpersonal inequality and features of or indicators of race and ethnicity, right? So we refer to these characteristics as deep roots, and I'll talk about that in just a second. So we have a feature, we have a picture of change on the one hand up here and very strong stability down here. So in the paper, we're effectively making an argument that there's really two driving forces behind these trajectories of social mobility, one related to change and one related to persistence. So that first set of characteristics really are really attributes related to the structure of the economy. And you can think about the structure of the economy in two ways. So one is in terms of how education is rewarded. So we know that in the US, as the 20th century progressed, the labor market became increasingly skill biased, meaning that to achieve higher levels of income, you needed to also have, higher levels of education. The second feature, in terms of the structure of the US economy, is its geographical footprint. So remember earlier on, I showed you that the Rust Belt, or what has become the Rust Belt, really was a leading economic powerhouse of the early 20th century. Incomes in that region have really sank over the 20th century. And so what we're seeing here is effectively two forms of change within the economic realm of the US, right? There's changes in how work is rewarded, education has a higher value today than it did in the past. But we've also seen these big geographical shifts in the economy. And effectively what we're arguing is that these structural shifts bring about changes in the geography of social mobility, right? It's effectively a mechanism of change. Now, the second set of mechanisms that we focus on is really this idea of what we're referring to and what we're putting forward is an idea of deep roots and interpersonal inequality. And effectively what we're thinking about here are long-term interactions between populations in places that have very persisting effects on outcomes over time. Okay, so the classic case that you can think about here and that's received a lot of work is effectively the impact of racial segregation and race relations throughout much of the US, and in particular in the South, as a set of interactions that shape things all across the social spectrum, from policing to how education gets funded in particular places, to the social interactions between African Americans and whites in the US. And effectively what we're saying is that this is, and this tier of characteristics that fit within this kind of deeply rooted socio-cultural interaction kind of framework, these tend to generate very strong persistence. And I think actually even a lot of the work that that Neil and Greg have done, for example, I think actually could be thought of in terms of this kind of deep roots kind of framework. There's also been a lot of recent work focusing on how the settlement of European populations in different parts of the US has given rise to many different types of local social institutions and schooling frameworks and so on and so forth. And there are features of these data that actually show up here as well. So effectively what we're making a case for is that the changing landscape of opportunity can be understood between these two tiers. One, in terms of change related to the structure of the economy, and another that's much more related to persistence, which is really rooted in these kind of deep roots, population interactions at the local level, and are particularly strongly tied to features of interpersonal inequality. So we have this kind of, these two forces of change and stability. To quickly touch on a couple of other features, I don't need to speak too much about it. The Black population share is actually the single strongest predictor of social mobility in the US over time. So really, you cannot talk about the landscape of opportunity in the US without addressing racial inequality. Those two things go hand in hand in the US. Economic forces, those features of change that I talked about earlier, seem to be less powerful in generating social mobility today than they were in the past. And we do also find, but I haven't spoken about it, that internal migration is an important force in generating opportunities. And what's interesting there is actually migration rates have been also falling in the US over exactly the same period that social mobility has been falling. So as I get to the end of this part of the talk, let me just touch back on those two questions that we began with. The first question of whether the geography of opportunity is something new or a continuation of long-term trends. Well, clearly it's not an either or, right? There's strong trajectories of both change and stability. We need to think about it in those terms. And in terms of the forces that drive opportunity, well, we have these economic features that generate change, but then we also have these deeply rooted characteristics in communities and local areas that have these strong kind of force that generate these strong forces of persistence. So effectively what we say is that social mobility is basically a product of deep roots on the one hand and the changing economic fortunes of places on the other. So the best mix is obviously a strong labor market and favorable social conditions, which is certainly no small ask. Okay, so that's what we've been doing in terms of that, you know, particular project on long-term social mobility. As I said, the first round of the findings have been published in PNAS, and there's a couple of different extensions that we're working on at the moment. But what I want to transition to briefly, I have it as about 10 minutes left. Is that right now?
Yes, please proceed.
I just want to take about 10 minutes to just talk through really the kind of next steps. And actually this work is in collaboration with Michael, but then Michael Storper connected Tom and I together, Tom Kennedy on the one of the organizers here, and kind of put us together within, you know, to get us thinking about the kind of things that I'm going to talk about here. And I'm going to focus, this is a big project, but I'm going to focus on a very specific part of it, and that's relevant to social mobility in particular. So the key findings of the study I just presented is that structural changes in the economy, or one of the key findings, structural changes in the economy can reshape the geography of social mobility. So remember the decline of the Rust Belt as an opportunity-generating region, the increasingly higher mobility in places that invest in schooling, is another feature of that work, particularly as the economy has become more skill biased. But the key question is, you know, how exactly do these structural changes in the economy take place and unfold? And then how do they actually come to generate changes in social mobility and inequality patterns? So, so effectively what we're doing here is we're taking a deep dive into these big economic transformations that, you know, reshape the geography of work and social mobility and inequality, trying to understand the dynamics of those changes and then how they translate into important outcomes. So in this particular component of the work, what we've started to look at is we've effectively started to take a deep dive into the manufacturing revolution in the US, running from roughly 1880 up to, at this point, we're running up to roughly 1950. And what we're looking at effectively in this, what is now referred to as the Second Industrial Revolution, we're looking at how manufacturing employment shifted over time, and then how those shifts connect with all sorts of different outcomes. So these kind of changes are now, you know, widely referred to as industrial revolutions. And one of the, one of the driving forces behind these industrial revolutions are the invention of new technologies, effectively. So the spread of new productive technologies throughout the economy and reshape many aspects of economic and social life. But we were like acutely aware of the fact that the way these technologies spread in these revolutions is not just random, right? These things don't just spread by themselves. So what we're also looking at in this, in this project are effectively the spatial behaviors of the people that innovate and use these technologies. So we're going to refer to these people as leading edge workers. So effectively what we're looking at is the unfolding of manufacturing in general, but then also the geographical behaviors of its leading edge, right? So effectively the people who are kind of advancing that industrial revolution on into new places and into new economic frontiers. So the basic hypothesis here for this talk is we expect that manufacturing and particularly its leading edge, so that's gonna be really the kind of the vanguard of this industrial revolution, will play a key role in reshaping the geography of social mobility in the United States. And in the interest of time, I'm just going to parse through this quickly. I'll give you just a couple of numbers of the kind of quantitative impact of the Second Industrial Revolution on the US. So here we have the year, manufacturing workers in millions, and the share of the labor force in manufacturing. What you can see from 1900 through to 1940 is that effectively the number of manufacturing workers in the US goes from roughly 2 million in 1900 up to 9.2 million by 1940. And it jumps again actually in the across the Second World War period and once we hit 1950. So big absolute numbers. And as a proportion of the labor force, that jumps from roughly 21% up to 28%. So, you know, there's big changes going on in the labor force across this period. So just to kind of touch on the kind of key components of what we're doing here, this study is possible because of the release of these big non-anonymized census data sources in the US. We grabbed the censuses through 1880 all the way through to 1940. We pull out all workers, but then also focus particularly on the manufacturing side of it. This is kind of big historical data. That's 101 million workers we're looking at. 23% of them are in manufacturing, and we observe them in one of seven decades. So effectively what we're using these data for is to try and describe the revolution itself. And for those of you who are, interested in the possibilities of doing linked research and kind of building historical longitudinal samples, actually my collaborators, Leah Bustan and Rana Bramitsky, have actually published a set of crosswalks that allow you to link people through the censuses with public data. They have a website, the Census Linkage Project, and they've published crosswalks for every person that they've managed to link between all of these censuses. So effectively, you can download your data and start to actually construct these longitudinal samples yourself as of just a couple of months ago. So all the years of work that went into the first part of the project is now freely accessible to anybody who wants to try to build these kind of longitudinal samples. So effectively, we use these to measure social mobility across that period from 1880 through to 1950. We focus on, again, low-income fathers and their sons and where they end up in the income distribution as adults. And effectively, what we want to do is to stitch these two pieces together, right? So we have the unfolding of the manufacturing revolution, and then we want to see if you're a place that's attracting manufacturing employment, how do these changes in the economic structure locally translate into social mobility rates? I'll leave that. Okay, so let me just point to two findings, and then I'll conclude. So these are just a couple of maps. On the left-hand side, you've got all manufacturing workers. On the right-hand side, you have what we refer to as leading-edge manufacturing workers. So these are skilled workers in manufacturing, basically. And the darker areas are going to be places that have more concentration. So if we just flick through this over time, you can see this kind of darkening of the maps, which suggests a kind of a greater prominence for manufacturing workers in local labor forces. You can see the development of this kind of northeastern corridor and also the south. But one of the really strong features of this map is actually that if you look at these two maps, they look almost identical, except for the south. So you can see that the south has developed this strong concentration of manufacturing workers. But in terms of leading edge manufacturing workers, they've attracted almost none. So effectively what you're seeing over time is an intensification of manufacturing in the economy as a whole, spreading to new places. But when it comes to the leading edge workers, they're really concentrating in these northeastern and midwestern regions, not moving at all to the south, right? So that's one of the important things to pick out. And let me just turn to this. I'm sorry to drop a regression table on you in the very last slide of the talk. But you don't need to worry too much about the technicals. I'll just talk through exactly what we're seeing here. So we've effectively set up a time series or panel regression model where we have all of these snapshots of these places over time, right? It's like a series for all of these places from 1880 all the way through to 1940. The thing that we're predicting is the average social mobility within that place. And then what we're looking at is how changes in local manufacturing, local leading edge manufacturing, and other proxies for more general changes like urbanization, how those changes over time correlate with upward social mobility, right? So we're looking at how local economic change relates to social mobility across the full period. I just want to focus on two findings here. The first is that if we look at these coefficients here, you see these strong positive effects for the manufacturing share, for urbanization, and for the leading edge share. So all positive, all significant. So increases in local manufacturing do translate into improvements in local social mobility. What's interesting is if this was a story of just about manufacturing, we wouldn't expect to see a positive effect of the local leading edge share. But we do, and it's about half the size of the effect of the average manufacturing effect. So what this suggests is, you know, very roughly and preliminarily, in terms of your hit for manufacturing, in terms of boosting your social mobility, about two-thirds of it is attributable to general manufacturing changes, and another third of it, you get that extra bump if that manufacturing tends to be particularly highly skilled. Don't worry too much about these difference coefficients, but the point that I want to make here in terms of this finding is we actually see that the effect of manufacturing on social mobility actually falls over time locally. So whatever that bang was for social mobility mattered more in the early part of our period, but declined over time. But actually the local leading edge share of manufacturing, that effect actually increases over time. So it becomes more and more important for your social mobility that you attract the skilled components of manufacturing. And I'll tell you why that's important in just a second. Okay, so just to summarize the early findings here, this is super preliminary work, so feedback from anybody is hugely appreciated. The preliminary findings we have on the second part of the project is that, you know, we see, first of all, you know, we observe this expansion of manufacturing. We observe very different geographical behaviors among the leading edge and non-leading edge workers. Particularly, the leading edge workers seem to be reluctant to move to the south. And this is important because what we see is that manufacturing did boost social mobility, but it had a particularly strong effect when manufacturing was of this kind of leading edge nature, so effectively more skilled over time, which has, of course, major implications for low mobility regions. So as I said a minute ago, the South did capture manufacturing. In fact, it was the it experienced the highest growth in national manufacturing over our period. It shifted from effectively 13% of national manufacturing to 21%, but it didn't capture that leading edge component effectively. And what I just showed is that you get that really strong extra bump from having that dimension of leading edgeness. One potential explanation here is that not only does the South have these issues related to the kind of deep roots characteristics that I talked about earlier, but it does also seem to have this kind of important economic structural difference too, and that it doesn't seem to be capturing the kind of the leading edge or vanguard of the economic transformations that are occurring otherwise. So it's effectively a kind of a double disadvantage in some respects. So that second part is very early. I want to conclude there, kind of welcome comments on either part. But that more recent bit is brand new. So I look forward to your feedback and thanks for sticking with me.
All right, thanks a lot, Dylan. So I've got some thoughts, which I think I'll communicate to you maybe privately. So let's just open this up to the floor. So I've been watching the chat here, and I told some guys back earlier that I'd call on them. So Tom asked a question, Tom Kameen.
Hi, Dylan. Really enjoyed your talk, super interesting. So I wanted to ask a question about the first part of the talk, and specifically about the sort of the intersection of spatial mobility and intergenerational mobility. And it's especially in the first period, the sort of pre-Chetty period. We know that that's a period in which there are very high levels of internal migration in the United States. And especially, you know, thinking about this sort of the finding around African Americans in the South, that of course there's this huge exodus in the form of the Great Migration. And so, you know, lots of African Americans are sort of trying to find their fortune moving to industrialized northern cities. You sort of had one bullet about migration, but I wanted to know sort of more about if, for instance, the low findings, the sort of low levels of intergenerational mobility in the South have something to do with the fact that those who do well have escaped from the South, essentially, and how you account for that and sort of what role that plays in what you're showing us.
Yeah, thanks, Tom. That's a great question. So there's two things. So one is technical. So the question is, well, if you move away, are you not captured in the social mobility of your place? So the thing to remember in what we're doing is that these estimates are based on your childhood vocation. So if you move somewhere else and you're upwardly mobile in that labor market, that's going to show up in your childhood location. So there's not a case that African Americans are moving away, being upwardly mobile, and then that's not being picked up in the South, because that should feature into it. But what is super interesting about this question, and it's something that a couple of people in the US are focused on at the moment, is that there were very high rates of out-migration from the South. But what people have actually started to show is that as African Americans moved into northeastern cities and northern cities in general, the types of structures that allowed particularly second generation immigrants, let's say from Europe, to move up the ladder a lot of those opportunities were pulled in. So you get things like schooling segregation, you get, you know, labor unions. And so actually race is effectively something that travels with you, right? So what people have been shown effectively is that those local contexts actually became more exclusive. And once they started to receive these kind of flows of African-Americans into their local labor markets. So there is this tie between migration and race for sure. And just the last thing I'll say on that is that the one thing that I didn't talk about is that middle region of the country where people are very upwardly mobile today. Those outcomes are not necessarily coming from people staying in those regions, but actually benefiting from the local schools and then actually moving to other parts of the country. So there is a mobility element baked into this. Thanks, Tom.
Okay, so I'm going to call people in the order that I see a full question detailed here. So I'll call on Powell now and then Jim Kusher after Powell.
Hi, hello. Thank you so much for this very fascinating presentation. And here I have three questions, and one first one I think would kind of echo the Tom's question. So like on the very conceptually, how should we think about social mobility in the spatial terms? So if I can improve my positional distribution because I move out from someplace, or does it say something about social mobility in the place where I'm coming from, or rather where I'm going to? That's kind of my first one. How should we conceptually, where should we locate the social mobility in the destination, on the place where you're coming from, or the host place? Now, I was also wondering, so you mentioned that, now echoing the news comment, that you measure position relative to the national distribution. So you look at people at the 25th percentile of the national distribution. Now, I think the problem could be here that it's probably, if we're looking at a very high income place, then you're gonna have relatively few people being born at the 25th percentile, and probably this would be extremely poor people for the given place, and vice versa. If you look at very poor places, the 25th percentile may actually be pretty good location distribution. So I expect that, you know, this 25th percentile will mean different things in different places, and this may correlate a lot with the income. And so I was actually wondering whether you were like, either maybe to account for the cost of living across places, or maybe to actually look at this local level distributions, although here I understand that this becomes a problem if you want to capture the migration, because then it's not obvious to what thing we should compare. And just final comment, in the first map you show in the early 20th century, it's clearly visible that there is some discontinuities along the states' borders. So you see that some states are simply different than the other states. And I was wondering whether this is because of some state level policies.
Thanks for that. Those are all great questions. So the first question is whether we should focus on the origin or the destination. And I think what we need to do is to think of both, but I think that there is a serious technical challenge there and that you're trying to think of two moving parts, right? And I think the rationale for the focusing on the childhood location is that effectively that's the thing that structures, you know, your opportunities to go elsewhere. So one of the kind of key points here is that these kids obviously receive their school, let's say if we take schooling, for example, we know that your propensity to attain a high level of education or to move on average, is structured relatively early in your life, right? So you kind of have this kind of, there's a theoretical reason to focus on the childhood context, but I think you're totally right that actually thinking about actually how a place positions you to move to other places is something that, you know, we could definitely incorporate and try to add into the analysis, and we've yet to do that yet. In terms of the local or the national, we've looked at so we have taken this national approach focusing on people at the 25th percentile in the national distribution. But actually in the appendix, we show that actually the local churning, if we take a more localized approach, is actually very highly correlated with the national outcome as well. So those two things do actually seem to go hand in hand. In terms of the states, I think there's definitely state policies at work, and in particular in the US schooling policy, for example, really there's sharp differences across states, particularly in the early 20th century. And I think there's, you know, that's one of many state level policies that I think could be at work here. But those are three great comments, and I really appreciate it.
Okay, so Jim is next.
Good morning, Dylan. Thank you for this fantastic work. Congratulations, well done. Fairly simple question that I think may have multiple complications, which is that when you talk about mobility, are you talking about mobility in both directions, meaning that the rich stay rich and the poor stay poor? And I think that's particularly interesting given what you've demonstrated in the southeastern portion of the country where, you know, there's historic inequality and all sorts of other fun things going on.
It's actually something that we haven't touched downward mobility at all. And I think that that's something that actually I would love to dig into more. So effectively, we've stopped at saying, okay, we're going to take these kids born into low-income families and look at where they move up. But of course, if you move up in a relative term, somebody has to move down. And we actually haven't looked at all in terms of, you know, the kind of patterns of downward mobility. But I think that's a fascinating thing. I think.
And so it's simply upward mobility that you're measuring at this point.
That's it. Yeah.
Thank you.
Thank you for that.
Okay. Next is Bozina.
So my question was, again, quite simple. To what extent, I'm not familiar with the way that the American census is built and to what extent it managed to capture the what share of the African-American community in the early 20th century. And also, could you provide details of the share of the African-American population in the South and in the Rust Belt and in the Northeast as well?
So thanks for that. So the two things there. The I think the census does a reasonably good job of capturing African Americans. Where the real struggle is actually in the linked data. African Americans are actually, particularly in the early 20th century, very difficult to follow over time. Partly due to selective mortality, some of it's to do with, you know, name changes or name commonness.
Exactly. Yeah.
So we do lose a lot of people for sure. Mm-hmm. In terms of the proportions relative to the South, the Northeast, and the Midwest, I actually don't have the statistics on hand. There is a lot of movement in our period from 1920 to 1940, and an even bigger movement once you move into the mid-20th century. So I don't have the exact numbers for how the shares between the three regions change, but there is a lot of movement for sure.
Right. From what I understand, one of the implications of the social, one of the reasons for the social inequality is the racism. Segregation, racial segregation. So I gathered from your slides that you were inclined to think that the South was more racially prejudiced than the North, but it may not necessarily reflect the truth, like the state of the current state of the
It's hard to say, you know, which, you know, whether a region is more racist than another region. But I think one thing that we can definitely say is that the structures that constrain, let's say, African-American social mobility were much stronger in the South than in the Northeast in the early 20th century. But I think what a lot of interesting recent work is showing is that as African-Americans move North, actually there was a kind of a balancing out of that where you start to get much more racist legislation in the North as a response effectively to the in-migration.
All right, thank you.
Thanks for that.
Okay, sorry folks. I guess my one job as chair, I'm kind of, not doing too great here, but we're supposed to end at 1:30 strictly. So I think we should just take this opportunity. I will pass on Daniel's question. I didn't get a chance to call on him and also Raphael's comment to Dylan. But I think we should all just thank Dylan for a terrific presentation, which I think, you know, to put it at a minimum, raises just a lot of different dimensions, which are, you know, really at the core of not just contemporary academic debate, but of you know, things that are really animating our lives these days, the non-pandemic part of our lives, at least. Anyway, But yeah, thank you, Dylan. And thanks to everyone for coming, and see you again.
Really appreciate it. Thanks for sticking with me, everyone, and great to see you.